Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Cosmos Magazine, issue 81, episode number 2. I've got through the first articles and now I'm reading the specialist contributors, and this is Saber Rattling Deep Underground. Scientists are searching for dark matter, whatever that means. A lot of these things on the edge of interest have no reportable findings. Okay, look up at night, every atom you can see in all those stars, indeed all the stars and gases that you can't, outweighed five times over by an invisible, completely unknown form of mass, fittingly termed dark matter. It's a gravitational glue around which galaxies move and our sun orbits. I suppose that might be right. Indeed, without the extra gravity, the Milky Way would not have formed. There would be no stars and no ice. Determining the particles that comprise dark matter would explain the mass of the universe than all the science to date. Well, yeah, it's if they are particles, that's my big question. You know, my view is that any attempts to measure particles are saying that they're not particles that interact, so as we know. There are a few questions more critical, basic or challenging to pose than uncovering the nature of dark matter. That is why astronomers have turned the most powerful telescopes to the heavens for over half a century to tease out any signatures that may imprint on the visible component of the universe. However, to truly explore dark matter, we need to measure it in the lab. I'm involved in an effort directly to detect halo of dark matter distributed around throughout the Milky Way. Fortunately, no interstellar travel is required because this experiment takes advantage of a phenomenon familiar to anyone who is driven in the rain. Although rain falls vertically, it appears to rush horizontally at an agreed speed toward the car when windscreen at the last moment. But of course, it's your car moving through it. So too, the sun moves at 230 kilometers per second around the Milky Way and through the accompanying dark matter halo. For us, the Earth, if it's there is a dark matter wind from the direction of the sun, is moving through. The headwind guarantees vast numbers of particles pass through. Look towards the constellation Cygnus, the direction the sun is moving in the Milky Way, and 10 million dark particles pass through your eye each second. Well, I don't know where that figure came up from. Why would 100 million be correct or incorrect? I don't understand how you don't know the mass of it. You don't know anything about it. How can you say that? Yet you would have to wait years for a single collision to occur between this wind and the ghost-like particles and the atoms of your retina. Such weakly interacting massive particles, WIMPs, is the prime target of SABRE, the world's first dark matter detector in the Southern Hemisphere. SABRE, which stands for Sodium Iodide and with Active Background Rejection Experiment, is actually two detectors, one in Italy, the other in Australia. The latter is led by the University of Melbourne's Elisabetta Barbarito and comprises of a nationwide effort involving ANU, University of Adelaide, ANSTO, and my own team at Swinburne. There are also international partners, INFN, in Italy, Princeton in the US. The detector is based on a salt crystal that flashes or scintillates when a WIMP collides with a sodium or iodine atom that causes a nuclear recoil, like billiard boards colliding in a pool table. The problem is that these same crystals will flash when struck by other particles too, and these events are trillions of times more numerous than dark collisions. So a trillion is a million million. The first source of blinding background light is the high-energy particles from space, known as cosmic rays, formed in the explosion of stars and feeding the black holes. Okay. Every postage stamp star is the area of the Earth's surface, including you, is struck by a cosmic ray each minute, which I think is true. To escape this bombardment, SABRE is a good solution. We're going a kilometre underground in an active gold mine in Stalwell, Victoria, using a layer of rock to block the particles and overwhelming the detector. Although we can go underground to escape cosmic radiation, there's the natural radiation of the crystal, the experimental vessel, and even researchers themselves, all vastly overwhelming the handful of light flashes we might hope to see from dark matter in a year. To mitigate this, Princeton's Frank Capris has created some of the least radioactive crystals ever, which we then immerse in a 3-meter wide steel cauldron filled with liquid alkali benzene, a fluid that also scintillates when struck by particles. If the crystals record a flash, but the fluid does not, then it's inconceivably unlikely that dark matter, so rarely interacting, has struck twice before it must strike another, and the event can be vetoed from the record. Okay, so if you get, it's a differential scintillation, just a particle comes through, so a double flash gets pulled out. SABO is installed in Stalwell in 2019. It will be in the dark at the bottom of a gold mine. We'll wait for a tiny flash that betrays the greatest mystery of the universe. Well, I think... Yeah, I'm just a bit dubious about the whole thing. Okay, letter to a student, Year 10. Dear Julian, you lamented that you're anxious about your subject choices in Year 11 and 12. You're alone. These are important decisions and there's lots of confusing advice around. In my career, I've been an academic researcher, a businessman, a university chancellor, and now a governor advisor. Based on this experience, some warm advice. For starters, a solid foundation to keep the doors of opportunity open. This means building your expertise in two fundamental subjects, English and mathematics. Neither can be picked up easily later in life. They are best learnt layer upon layer from prep school to year 12. Mastery of language is crucial to succeeding whatever you do, whether it's writing a report to advise a government on electricity markets or a job application. Your ability to win friends and influence people will only be as good as your language skills. The best way to hone them is to read a lot and read some more novels, history, science fiction. It doesn't matter, just read. Mathematics is a language of science and commerce. I can't emphasize that for many tertiary study fields, you have a strong knowledge of mathematics. This includes medicine, science, engineering, economics, commerce. If you like, you can look at it from a fundamentalist point of view. In the beginning, there was mathematics, and the mathematics begat physics, and physics begat chemistry, and chemistry begat biology, and biology begat commerce. With the basics in place, next choose subjects that will stretch you. Why is breath a good thing? In my case, I studied sciences and mathematics right through. But I also picked up Year 12 economics, which helped me in the business policy development. You can't find it, you'll find it easier to choose subjects you like, although my own experience is that nearly all subjects, even economics, are interesting once you knuckle down and get past the initial barriers. What's left? There's not just intellectual robots. We are a complex fusion of mind, body and emotion. Besides English and mathematics, there are two other fields that you should keep us as long as you can, even if you don't do them as formal subjects. These are music, the language of emotion, and sport, the language of body. Music and sport complete the human beings. Like English and mathematics, they are incredibly difficult to pick up later in life. There you go. I don't know why, but some well-meaning advisors will suggest you pick easy subjects that you will achieve at higher raw score. Don't do that. You won't be doing yourself a favour. You'll be diminishing your long-term prospects. Instead, choose enabling subjects, the ones that will keep your doors and opportunity open. Every time you drop enabling subjects, bang, the door of opportunity slams shut. Well, there you go. It's interesting, sport and all that type of stuff. You'll hear lots of talks about 21st century skills, such as resilience, clear thinking, collaborations. These are important, but in truth, these were 20th century skills too. I learned them a long time ago. They're important, but they're useless unless you study demanding subjects through which you can practice these skills. It's like playing basketball. You need to know the rules, on-court behaviour, but unless you practice, you won't make the team. There's no substitute for raw knowledge, even in the age of internet and search. After all, there's no use learning to collaborate if you don't have anything distinctive to contribute. Another way to build these 21st century skills is by volunteering to do some community service, taking on a casual job, perhaps at McDonald's or a local cafe. To finish, two comments about careers. First, be aware employers look for T-shaped individuals, where the vertical pole and a T represents the deep discipline, specific knowledge, and the horizontal bar represents 21st century. Restrict your focus on one or the other, and you'll be limiting your employment options. Second, in the era in which tertiary studies determine your lifelong career is over. You might do science but pivot to business. You might do engineering but pivot to politics. You might do accounting but pivot into a job that hasn't been invented yet. The real thinking is to do your initial tertiary studies really well. That's how you hone your skills. After that, in the workforce, it'll be easy to pivot from one career to another. There is, of course, much more to do filling life. That's a suggestion, but I trust this will help. Very warm regards, the incurable engineer. It's interesting to see that one. So, dark matter, how absolutely incredibly stupid that is, but the double scintillation is good, and doing career, what a beautiful way of putting that forward. So, the bottom line here I'm picking up is that on one aspect I'm producing a detailed view of things, but on the other it's not really getting there. So if I can do a synopsis of my research paper, which is really interesting in that I'm sort of divorced and separated from it, so just if I can really get into it. If I can put it into a postage stamp. From the front line, Ag Science gets a feminine touch, brought to you by the Council of Deans of Agriculture. Fiona Simpson's is the first president of the National Farmers Federation in 2016 reflects the revolution underway in the agricultural science. It's blossomed from a male-dominated field to one that now boasts an equal gender balance, putting it ahead of other disciplines as engineering, information technology and architecture. Although ag science has long been open to girls at university, up until the 1970s, only boys were admitted to agricultural courses in high school and colleges. So, in reality, very few, if any, females studied at tertiary level. An early exception was Irene Myrtle Lau, who won the scholarship to the Melbourne University in 2013. The twist, the daughter of Judy Thompson recently told the ABC, was that this had to include a year's practical experience at Dookie Agricultural College, which until then had never had a female student. Lau survived the stares and student silliness and staff cynicism to complete a year and return to Melbourne to finish her degree. With so many boys gone to war, she was the only person to graduate in BG Ag in 1918. This is very much a one-off, however. No other female was accepted to study till 1947. Real change did not begin till the 1970s, when the Stuart University's James Presley apparently suggests there may have been an epiphany as agricultural institutions transitioned to coeducational against the backdrop of the Whitlam government and social reforms in the International Women's Year in 1975. Despite this, things still moved slowly. By 1988, many females as males were enrolling in university colleges, but this didn't happen in ag science until 2003. Helen Ross at the University of Queensland noticed a growing number of female students at the time on what had previously been a very, very male-dominated campus. Speculates that the millennium drought may have been a factor. Evidence suggests women are particularly conscious of sustainability issues. Around the world, women are becoming more involved in the value chain of agriculture, says Margaret Alston of Monash University, and needs to train them into food production is really imperative to food security. Food security is going to be an issue of the 21st century if we want to be able to be on top of that in this country. We need to harness the best minds and the best graduates, she says. Despite agriculture's blokey image, women have already toiled behind the scenes. And 3 years, the Invisible Farmer Project, funded by the Australian Research Council, aims to push them a little more into the limelight. The project is a collaboration between rural communities, academics, governments and cultural universities, driven by the 2014 Australian Women in Agricultural White Paper that argued that women are vital to the innovative, productive Australian agriculture in all its contexts. That includes Australian Indigenous women and their 50,000 years of knowledge in managing and nurturing the land, according to the project's website. Oh, well, dear. Simpson very much agrees. In a speech to the National Press Club back in August, the NAF president acknowledged the historic and ongoing role of Aboriginal elders in Australian agriculture. She's also called for diverse initiatives to cultivate and grow Australian agriculture under the canopy of a comprehensive government national strategy, and highlighted the agricultural's enormous contribution to Australia's GDP. But, she added, it's crucial that we find the right balance between environmental outcomes and the production of food and fibre, underpinned by evidence-based science and sensible policy, that we need to support the growing population. Okay. Arsene, for one, is impressed. She's a terrific leader, she says. For all sorts of reasons, she's a breath of fresh air in the role. That's certainly opening up for a debate for certain sorts of issues that need to be addressed. Tertiary education is preparing future graduates to address the challenges Simmons and others have raised. Ross says the program at the University of Queensland takes undergraduates through climate change, food security and water, and water as three important issues that affect the planet. These core themes are contextualised: population growth, biodiversity and land use, and preparing students to think like leaders who can work collectively to, quote, change things for the better world. Expanding this, the NFF has established a diversity in agriculture leadership program that provides one-to-one mentoring in aspiring female leaders in agriculture. To this end, Simpson is pleased to see young women better represented at the tertiary education level. What needs to happen next is more overt awareness of the fact that a lot more women have agricultural training skills if you want to make the best use of the skill base we have in Australia. Okay, just see how many minutes this is and how much I can read. It's only 17 minutes. I must be powering along. Hopefully I'm getting over. Okay, triathletes compete in the 3.8 kilometre swim during the Ironman World Championships in Hawaii. Mind muscles, how to age well. When it comes to exercise, it's never too late. It can change the dynamics of getting older. Well, hopefully this is it. Okay. I've driven through the coal-rich soils of Australia's Latrobe Valley, past the apocalyptic towns of Yulawn Station to Maffra, a dairy town set amid farm-studded flatlands that sweeps the parallel rise to the serried peaks of the Great Dividing Range. This is Carla McCarrion's country, one of the undulating bitumen of Maffra backroads. The 72-year-old retired anaesthetist has honed a physique that allows her to do things many people 50 years her junior would find impossible. Last year, she completed the Ironman World Championship in Kona, Hawaii. For the uninitiated, that's a 3.8-kilometre swim and 180-kilometre bike ride topped with a marathon across the unforgiving windswept southeastern tip of Nauru Island. McKinney greets me at the door of her modest house. She is elfin, clad in sports gear, and sprouts a stock of white hair above the steely gaze that reeks of determination. Across the kitchen table, she gives clues to where the grit comes from. Quote, when I was a kid, I was always the top of the class at school, but in sport, although I was sporty, I made the school team. I was never number one, she says. Our chit-chat takes into the almanac of sporting achievements that would seem to have made for the deficiency. 19 Ironman races since the age of 16. First Australian female over 70 to complete the Kona. Fastest time of 12 hours 54 minutes. To give perspective, that's more than an hour faster than the time set by the Australia's younger, famously fit former Prime Minister Tony Abbott in his debut of the Ironman competition 2010. It's a CV that looks firmly in the reserve of the freakish elite. And Curran may well be off the agenda for most elder folk, but science is delivering a loud message to those who think getting old means inevitable sighted decrepitude. The key to physical prowess may well lie in your hands or legs. Actually, let's start with your head. Joe Baker, an exercise scientist at York University in... Toronto, Canada, is researching the insidious effect of age stereotypes. I'm 50 next year, and I wake up and my back is sore, and I don't have the flexibility I used to, Baker told me over Skype. It's so easy just to say, well, yeah, I'm getting older, but hold on, you're buying into the stereotype at that point. This is no pull yourself up by the bootstraps platitude, as Baker makes it clear in a study his team has just run. They had two groups of older adults read fake newspaper articles about how elderly negotiate stairs. One group read an article saying stair climbing worsens with age due to frailty, shakiness and general inability. Switching paradigms, the second group read how stair climbing improves with age due to accumulation of experience, resilience and fitness. On subsequent stair climbing class, not only were those who read the downer message about aging less confidence and more scared of falling, their biomechanics worsened and they were less steady on their feet. It's a phenomenon called priming, where simply activating a mental concept such as being old makes you unsteady can be self-fulfilling. That concept, however, gains little truck with it one particular group. We haven't been able to draw a link between negative stereotypes and older athletes because they don't seem to buy into the identification with the older adult group. Interesting. It's perhaps no coincidence then that back in Mafra, McKinley has a positive self-affirmation such as tough it out, and so if you fail, try one more time, scrawled in neat cursive on a whiteboard. I think it's quite clear for performers at any levels, at any age, those kinds of messages have a positive effect because they increase confidence as they increase self-efficacy, says Baker. Winding back age, however, isn't just the mind. Research is underway in Melbourne, is showing that exercise can literally make your body younger. I have huffed and puffed on my bicycle to the Institute of Health and Sport at New Victoria University in Footscray. It's a hive of offices and bicycle-rigged exercise lab nestled in the once picturesque, now heavily industrialised bank of the Melbourne's Maribyrnong River. I'm in there to meet exercise geneticist Nia Aron and postdoctoral researcher Sarah Visson across a boardroom table. They mention intriguingly that their current study involves chipping, so we head down to the lab to see what that entails. There... it's not a deep fry in sight. We meet a young man peering intently into a tiny piece of frozen red meat that he's manipulating with a scalpel and tweezel. It's a fragment of human thigh muscle being chipped into slices to process the DNA analysis. Aaron and Viren are part of a study called GeneSmart. Acronym stands for Skeletal Muscle Adaptive Response to Training, in which nearly 100 men have donated a snippet of quadriceps to their epigenetic age. Epigenetics, a researcher explains, is a study of things that that can turn on genes on or off, including environmental factors such as toxins, stress, whether altering the genetic code down at the DNA level. One process that flicks the gene switch is called methylation. When you have DNA strand, you have an ACTG codes that together in the double helix, said Verson. Methylation is just an addition of a methyl group to cytosine. It's like a lollipop attached to the cytosines in your DNA at different spots. As it happens, we all have different percentages of methylated cytosine. Pioneer work by UCLA scientist Steve Howarth used the fact to create the so-called epigenetic clock. Using data from thousands of people, Huff found DNA methylation levels reliably predict chronological age, so you get methylated. Violin tells me that calorie restrictions can produce epigenetic signature or biological age younger than a person's chronological age. This is much less clear, she says, whether exercise could have a similar effect. To find out, she and Ethan had their participants ride exercise bikes to exhaustion to gauge the VO2 max, the maximum amount of oxygen they can use, peak power, lactate threshold, and levels of enzymes called citrate synthesis, a marker of efficient energy production. Each person was assigned a fitness score, and researchers compared the fitter half with the less fitter half. Back at the boardroom, Vaisan is posed to swing her laptop around and show me the results, which are being prepared for publication. I'm reminded of the art house auctioneer pulling back the curtain at the prize exhibit, and for the connoisseurs of statistics rouse, goodwill be a masterpiece. On the left plot, the less fit people show that their actual ages tally with their biological ages based on the DNA methylation. There are two linked in the ladder of roughly horizontal lines. On the right, however, the ladder for the fitter people is wonky. Their actual ages slope down in the uniform lines to match the lower biological ages, which are lower on average by 4 years. This is the first attempt to show exercise can slow down aging at the epigenetic level, says Voisin. The result, added Edison, is that exercise is setting up skeletal muscles to succeed. Epigenetic is priming the gene expression genes that are key to metabolism. The exercise adaptation and mitochondrial function are being altered a lot after exercise, he said. Mitochondria are the cell's powerhouse, where oxygen is converted into adenine triphosphate, ATP. Yes, honey? Okay, I'm just going to stop now.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.